Gosh, John, I forget how good you are at karate. That's incredible.
I know, man. I mean, it's all about the right belt.
It is. Timing, you know? Or your leather belt.
Exactly.
I feel like maybe, is that not, that's what you meant?
Not really, okay. But speaking of, Dave, wow, I'm just going to try to transition to save you. Finally, Dave.
Yeah.
Warm spring days are arriving.
Oh,
am I right?
Isn't it great? You know what? I need a new pair of shades that I don't have to baby. Do you know what I'm saying, John? I don't want to take care of them. Let me put them on, take them off, and not have to worry about
them. Hey, Dave, I know exactly
what you mean. Sorry, I didn't mean to rant.
Knock around is the solution. They've been making high-quality shades that don't break the bank since 2005.
Oh, wow.
And they've actually been my personal go-tos for years.
Oh, yeah. I love Knock Around, John. They have over 20 different frame styles, so there's something for everyone, including tons of kids' pairs.
That's right. So whether you're looking to rep your favorite sports teams, you know, like you're a sports guy, spend some relaxation time in the yard, or cruise down Broadway with the windows down like Dave does all the time.
All the time.
Every Tuesday and Thursday and Saturday. Knock Around, that's what you need.
Yeah. All of their lenses have UV 400 protection, which is basically like sunscreen for your eyes, which, by the way, I've tried that and it hurts. Use the sunglasses, everybody. With polarized adult pairs starting at $28, you can get a few pairs to leave in your car, toss in your beach bag, or lend to a friend in need.
Dave, that is such a good price that I might buy a pair just to intentionally lose them.
I don't love that logic, John, but
I know,
you do have a history of misplacement. It's Knock Around.
Don't fight me because of the karate stuff.
But it could be perfect for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, Dadville fans, don't squint through family beach days or trips to the park. Check out knockaround.com and use the promo code DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order.
That's DADVILLE15 for 15% off your order at knockaround.com. Hi, I'm Dave Barnes.
And I'm John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville.
Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
It's funny thoughts and deep talks.
So please, enjoy your time here in Dadville and enjoy this episode with...
John
McComber. It's a joy. Thanks for having
me
on.
We are so pumped to have you on. I don't want to...
Oh, it's great.
I'm trying to play it cool, but I just want to say up front, like, this is going to feel like an interview to you, hopefully. But what's actually happening is Dave and I are going to be battling hard because we already know we have too many questions for the time slot.
Where are you guys based? Where are you? You have cool, like, man cave rooms around you.
Yeah.
Where are you?
We're across the street from each other, and this is the truth. We are in Nashville, and John, literally, if I wanted to, I could run and be in picture in probably 30 seconds.
Amazing. And are you guys musicians, or what's, forgive my ignorance, what's the like background? How do you guys get to this?
When we're not modeling,
exactly.
We do play music.
Yeah, there's kind of a hierarchy of things.
Yeah, our list of importance. No, so John and I are both musicians. We've been doing... what we've done both about 20 years, you know, just singer-songwriter stuff. John and I met when he was still in college, and he opened for me and one of my best buds, a guy named Matt Wirtz. We were doing shows together, and we kept in touch. And then John and his wife are Indiana people, but moved here
coming up on 7 years. Yeah.
And so we've been buds for a long time, and this podcast, you know, it's on Annie's network, you know, Annie Downs network on her.
I didn't realize that.
That's fun. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Annie is sort of like the third member. She's like the Trinity of my marriage. She's like sort of the third. She's the Holy
Spirit.
She's
the Trinity of this marriage.
That sounds wrong on lots of
on a lot of levels. But it's been a good interview. Thanks for your time. But she's a dear friend. And so when she started, John and I had thought about doing this podcast because we sort of realized there wasn't like anything. The dad space for podcast stuff was just kind of wide open. And so we were like, it'd be really fun to, cause we end up, you know, we see each other at least once a day, and he's got two girls. I've got two boys and a girl.
Yeah.
But some, you know, that celebrated dads and sort of all things dad. And so it's been fun because we get these people on that are known for whatever, but then getting to talk more about that thing is such a fun, you see a lot of dads, you know, guys who are either whatever space they're in, you know, they're kind of used to talking about, but then kids is always sort of like
a whole other ball game.
Yeah, it's a whole other thing. Yeah, it's like you just see a total different side of, and not just their kids, but sort of how they think about parenting or their yeah. families, you know, all that stuff.
And in our experience, it's like that once we became parents, that's all I want to talk about. Yeah. That's all I want to post about, you know, so it's fun to have wow. like other musicians on who
yeah.
they get to talk about, you know, their life, their real life at home and all that. So
how old are your kids?
So we go, don't we stair step? Sam is, how old is he?
Four.
So Dave's got a 4-year-old. I got a 5-year-old girl. Then Dave's got a little girl, 6. And then Luca, our oldest little girl, is 8.
And then I have a 9-year-old boy.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, love it.
And how old are your three?
15, 12, and 12.
Oh, they're twins.
One's adopted.
Oh, I knew. I felt like when I was walking in, I was like, that came in really hot on that, and I could really regret that.
No, it's okay. Everybody does it. No, of course. Yeah.
That's amazing. So it's, again, John said it, and it is the truth. I mean, this was, we're thrilled you are here, and I think by the end of it, you might be fatigued just by, if nothing else, our excitement. But we start these with sort of like, the flyover, we call them the brag sheets, but yours is actually really humble. So it's not, I wish that there was a lot of flexing in there you didn't do, which, you know what? Points for you. You already have our respect in that aspect. But so here's some fun about JMC. I'm just calling you that. I don't know if we're there yet. You live in Portland with your wife, Tammy. We just talked about your three kids, Jude, Moses, and Sunday, which feels like if they don't start a band, the three of them, those are the coolest three names. Like, I feel like the bio.
Well, my oldest is like, that's what he wants to do with his life, is rock star. That's like his.
Okay.
He has hair, like curly hair down past his shoulders. He just got his ear pierced. He's like, he's 15. He looks like the lead singer of Laney or something. He's just like.
Yes, that's amazing.
Really? He went into COVID like in full on like awkward middle schooler mode, like gained, you know, like they say boys grow like out before they grow up.
Yeah. Right.
So
right.
He was like beanpole skinny his whole childhood, but short. And then he hit puberty and just like got really chubby and like hilarious looking. And I did this thing with him called the Primal Path, which we're still in. It's a 3-year initiation rite to manhood and intensive spiritual formation journey. We shaved his head on the first night, like the community of men around a fire, literally in the forest. We shaved his head and he looked like so bad. I mean, so bad. So he gained
all this weight. Did you have a moment after you did that where he's looking at your eyes and you're like...
I mean people didn't even know, is this your son, is this your daughter, is this people, I mean honestly it was hard to tell. So but then he went into COVID and you know nobody's seen him for like a year because we're in Portland, everything's liberals, which means you have to stay in your house or you're killing people. And so anyway, he's just emerged. He grew like shot up. He got super thin. His shoulders got broad. His hair's all long now. He pierced his ear. He's dressing all cool. And he's just like, I'm ready to be a lead singer, Dad. I'm ready.
He had the like COVID makeover.
Exactly. Everybody sees him. They're like, his voice dropped. So he has like deep like rock and roll voice. Like, hey, bro, what's up, dude?
Oh my gosh.
Anyway,
I feel like Portland, maybe more than any other city, would be prime for doing that to a kid.
Oh,
we'd just be like, we have all of the things to get you there.
Oh, and so, this is a long story, but the school system here has just been utterly co-opted by far left secular ideologies. So, much to our chagrin, we finally pulled him out of the public school system, homeschooled him for a couple of years, which I'm sure did not help his awkward middle schooler phase. But now he's gone to this private Christian school out in the suburbs, and he is just the coolest thing to ever happen to that school. He's like, Dad, these are all like kind of real suburban, like conservative rich kids. And like, they don't even know, he's walking in his Doc Martin boots and his long hair. And he's traveled the world with me and he's all cultured and cool. And all the girls are just like, he is the teenage heartthrob of Christian suburban Portland right now. You know?
That is amazing.
Dream.
That is, I did wonder about like the, with the pandemic, like what, because your son is the exact thing I was wondering about. I was like, I wonder what kids did that like Disney movie where you didn't see him for a year and they came back and it was like slow mo and he's like ripped and everybody's like, oh my God.
Oh my gosh.
You know? So you guys are in Portland, you have your three kids. And then this is really profound, and we'll talk about this, but so you're the pastor for teaching at Bridgetown Church, by Powell's Books, which all of us who traveled to Portland know all about Powell's Books. You've also written My Name is Hope, Loveology, Garden City, God Has a Name, and Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, which ruined my life, which is such a great book. We'll talk about that too. You have a master's degree in biblical and theological studies from Western Seminary. Where is Western?
It's in Southeast Portland, right in the city. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. And you are currently, this is incredible, currently working on a doctorate in spiritual formation.
No, I was.
You're done with that.
I quit.
Oh, you did it already.
No, I quit.
Oh, you quit. Touche. So this parlays into one of the things I want to ask first about Whit Fuller, which Dallas Woodard, which, you know, I know how much you talk about him and amazing things that man has done. So the thing that I did notice that wasn't in there is your telecast days, which I have to, like, John and I want to hear about this. Like, tell us about that. What, you were in a band, and that was like, when was that, like late 90s, early 2000s?
No, that would have been, I was only in telecast for about 10 minutes. That would have been
two songs,
2005, maybe.
Okay.
So I played in bands back in the day. I played in this band that called Coldplay for a little while.
I don't know if you've heard of her.
And then I played in this band called Keen for just a few years.
And then you decided to dabble in CCM.
And then I just
and then
decided,
they were like, "You're ready for telecast."
And then I wrote this song called "The Stand." And was just kind of done after that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I'm going to call it.
I have nothing more to add.
No, I played in bands all through high school and college. I was signed to Tooth & Nail back in the day.
Oh, yeah, dude. Oh, yeah. When it was that label was the coolest.
That was it.
Yeah. And so that's kind of how I met Josh, was through a previous band I played in. And then Josh, who's the lead singer of telecast, I actually hired him for the church that I had planted as our worship pastor. And he came up and he made a record or two when we were on staff together and brought me into his office to play guitar on a couple of songs. So that's me being in telecast.
The most pro way of being in a band I've ever heard in my life.
Totally what that means is like I played rhythm guitar on like three tracks, and I played we used to lead worship together every Sunday. So we were, a lot of those songs were from that record were written at our church. So I would, you know, play in that, but we were not touring the world for whoever, you know.
Yeah, MXPX.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we were a little bit more audio adrenaline.
So that, I just think that is so fascinating. I love these sort of like sidewinders that you go, oh, okay, telecast, look at you.
Yeah, dabbling. Look at me. Look at dabbling in in bands that never made it. Amazing.
Listen, anybody that ever got a deal makes it. That's my rule. Like, it doesn't matter what happened after that. So here's the thing I wanted to say. So a couple things. I literally, this is the truth. I think I have bought 15, and I'm not lying to you, 15 copies of Hurry. This is no lie. So I got on Amazon. I bought the first like five or six after I read it, had them sitting in my kitchen, and literally every human that came in, I just gave them to them. And I just did a reorder of that one because I just got through with Garden City too. And if you walk in my kitchen, there are four Garden Cities, there are three Annie Downs new book, that sounds fun, and then probably five Hurries just sitting for everybody that comes
in the
room.
That is so kind.
I do want to say, though.
Thank you for helping me pay the tuition for my son's high school.
We already transferred schools, so we want to do our part.
Between the school tuition and his hair product, I have no extra money right
you're
now.
Well, there's probably product for the earring thing, is upkeep with that. You know, you want to go organic.
Yeah, of course.
But I do want to say
you want to do the spray, and that, yeah, sure. You know,
Dave, that all of this is true, what he's saying to you, and it's true. I was in his house today. The stack of books are there.
It's there.
But he didn't give them to every human that walked through the door, because I walked through the door every day, and he would rave about this book, Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, and he's like, I'm giving it to everyone.
Except
I mean,
John.
He would tell me all these things, and I'm like, ah, that sounds like a really great book. And then I would leave empty-handed. So I bought my own copy right here. So I just wanted that to be known.
I see this is a very transactional relationship between you two. This is not a friendship.
I found that out recently, yes.
This is just what can I get from you for this podcast, John?
It's a very specific transactional relationship. So one, just John and I both love the book. I mean, and this is, I'm coming in with a really hot take here, but I think of the formative sort of Christian theological books I've read in my adulthood, I think it's probably Life Together would be like number one for me.
Wow, yeah.
And then I would put Hurry not too far after that. I think for the timing of it, and you know, I'm 42 now, and you can't tell I've had a lot of work done, but it's but it just was crazy, the timeliness of that book. And I think I read it at the end of last year, so I know it had been out for a minute. It was funny too, because I had a million friends tell me about it. Like I literally had a million friends and read it. But I thought you'd get a kick out of this. John and I are both in a club that's since been formed from reading the book called The Not Crushing It Club. And it was literally the inception. It was in the inception of this club. My best friend and I go on a walk once a week, which sounds like we're 80. And then
your best friend who's not John.
It's not John. Yes, John won't let me in there. Just, he's very specific
really
about his
rubbing
friends.
It in. You gave him two books.
You need some therapy. Keep going. Sorry.
Yeah. If you have any, you can dispense it for free right now. But Micah, my buddy, and I for 20 years, best bud, we're walking, and he'd read the book too. And I was just like, gosh, did this book just met? He's like, oh my gosh. And he's like, can we make an agreement? And John, we've opened the club up. John's in the club. We have a few other friends too. He said, can we just make an agreement this year that we're just not going to crush it? He's like, because this was like January. And I was like, that is one of the best things you've ever said. And he's like, we're just going to start a club. We're going to call it the Not Crushing It Club. Mm-hmm. And our goal for 2021 is to not crush it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I am so all in. But that all comes from Hurry. That comes mm-hmm. from the book. It's just this like, why are we killing ourselves to try to quote unquote crush it, whatever that means. And so he and I saw him the other day, and I was like, how's your day? And he 100% seriously looked at me. He's like, I kind of crushed it. I was like, oh. He's like, oh, no, I'm really disappointed.
Don't kick me out. Don't kick me out.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Johnny.
You know what's really been bugging me lately?
Can I get two guesses?
You can have three.
Ooh, okay. First of all, at the risk of being punny, mosquitoes?
Yeah.
Okay. Is two that LeBron just can't stay healthy?
Yes.
Gosh. That bugs me too. And then three, is it that your forehand is just not quite where you want it to be in your tennis game?
Absolutely not, and I'm offended by that.
Oh.
No, I'm sick and tired of going to the store and never knowing what products to buy to clean our house and your house. Because, you know, Amy and I have been cleaning your house for a while.
Yes, and that does mean a lot to us.
I always end up FaceTiming my wife so she can point me in the right direction to the products that are safe to bring in the house and actually get the job done.
Yeah. Man, do I know that pain. Mm-hmm. And to quote Sting, I'm actually the king of that pain.
Yep.
Spring cleaning is here, and it's important to find products that are going to be good for the fam.
Yeah.
But Johnny boy, do I know where to find that? Do you know where it is?
Tell me.
Grove Collaborative.
Tell me more, Dave.
Okay, you don't have to yell. Grove is the online marketplace that delivers healthy home, beauty, and personal care products directly to your front door. Grove Collaborative takes the guesswork out of going green. Browse their site for thousands of products, all guaranteed to be good for you, your family, and the planet. But do you know what the best part is, John?
Boy, do I.
Oh, you do? Okay, well, I'll tell you either way. They're all wife-approved.
So you're telling me I can find natural cleaning products that are safe for my family that come directly to my door.
That's right. And get this, besides being fast and convenient, the shipping on your first order is free.
Oh my goodness.
That's free dollars.
Here's what I want to know.
Okay.
How do I sign up?
Okay.
And where do I receive my Husband of the Year award for this one?
Let's handle those one at a time. First of all, making the switch to natural products has never been easier. For a limited time, go to grove.co/dadville and you'll get to choose a free gift. Jeez, these guys love free stuff. With your first order of $30 or more. But you have to use our special code. Johnny, what do you have to do?
You have to use a special
code. That's right. And the Husband of the Year Award, if I'm remembering right, is in August.
Okay.
But you have to have a certain amount of squeaky clean houses to even be in the
room. Okay. Well, I've got two going for me.
Okay, good.
So that's grove.co/dadville to get our exclusive offer.
Is that right? Yeah. Visit grove.co/dadville today. Get your clean on.
Dave, do you find I'm hearing a lot of men in particular seem to get a lot of traction from, like, if you want to call it a club, like small little groups of guys that form around some random thing, can be serious, can be not serious. Yeah. I feel like there's something about the male psychology that really seems to respond to that, something kind of playfully creating moments of vulnerability and some shared values that you're working toward.
Yeah. I wonder, it's something John and I talk a lot about in our friendship. I think there's just so many things, and it's one of the reasons that we've loved doing this. I can speak for me that I've loved doing this podcast, is a place for these things that seem to be sneak attacks. You know, as you get to an age that you sort of feel like, oh, I kind of know what's going on. And I kind of feel like, and then it just feels like in my late 30s and 40s, it was like, I say that like I'm 50 in the beginning of my early 40s. But, you know, just these things that I just didn't quite know were going to happen or have the tools to deal with. And so I think these sort of gatherings, these sort of collectives end up being these safe places you can kind of go like, hey.
Yes.
And, you know, too, and John's heard me say this quote. This is one of my favorite quotes of all time. But I heard a guy once say, whenever we come together sharing our strengths, it breeds competition. But whenever we come together sharing our weaknesses, it breeds community.
Yes.
And so I think for men, well, there is said. This beautiful place, you know, we can sort of get together and go like, hey, do you sort of feel like this? And you know.
Well,
you
I think that we need like permission. Mm. Guys need permission to like be vulnerable a little bit. Like, you know. I remember having a conversation with a friend years ago who was studying this kind of stuff in the workplace. And she was talking about how, like, when two guy coworkers chat around the office, they face like this. They don't face each other. They face outward.
Shoulder to shoulder.
Shoulder to shoulder. We need some sort of, like, triangulation.
Yeah, common task. Well, men bond, men especially bond, and this isn't, like, gender stereotyping. I think there's data here. Bond around shared partnerships and tasks, doing a podcast together, working together, playing sports together, playing in a band together. Guys love to play music together because you get these moments of vulnerability and humor, but you're creating together, you know?
Yeah. And I hope that it's, I think it definitely is changing in our culture. Like, we're all given license a little more and permission to be ourselves, whatever that looks like. But you know, for me, I'm 38 years old now, and so I just feel like I want to make up for lost time a little bit. Like, when I was 18, I wish I could have had the boldness and the bravery to just sort of be more who I am.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, this book, Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, is one of those books that I, as I'm reading it, I'm like, this is going to be a book that I read once a year, for sure. Yeah. This is like part of the routine. And I think that it, you know, I don't know how it would have hit me at 18, but it really, at 38, it really, like Dave said, is timely in culture and also just personally.
Yeah. That's so humbling and kind, you guys. I think sometimes we're just not, you have to reach a certain age and you have to have a certain level of certain amount of failure under your belt before you're really even seriously. Yeah, before you're totally. Even ready to start having the right conversations, you know, and we live, it's no surprise to me that you guys are forming your little club. We live in such a first half of life culture that does not prepare us. And, you know, first, second half of life is a very helpful psychological development pattern, but it's not an age, it's a stage. So it's not like at 40 or at 50 or whatever, there's this arbitrary shift. It's a stage thing. So for some people, they might enter a second half of life very early due to suffering or trauma or bereavement. Other people never enter it. But our entire culture is predicated upon, like, how do we keep first half of life and the illusion of upward mobility going? Mm-hmm. And that is a kind of trauma, like just living. I don't mean this in a victim kind of way, but just living in the Western what my therapist calls the gospel of upward mobility,
yeah,
is in of itself a kind of trauma, because life only, and for some people, life never feels up and to the right, whether it's because of racial injustice or because of poverty or because of trauma or because of family of origin, all sorts of different reasons. But let's say you have a decent family of origin, a decent start of life, you're middle class, whatever, you have the sense of up and to the right. Nobody keeps going to the right. And so but culture keeps telling us, go to the right.
Yeah.
And so at some point, life is no longer up and to the right. And then you face the trauma of living in a first half of life, upward mobility, performative identity, illusion of success culture. And it creates just massive fallout. And if you have people to process it with, it can be beautiful. And that can be your invitation to the inner journey, to maturity, to spiritual formation, or just to discipleship to Jesus and the inner life. But if you don't have people to process it with, it's traumatic. You know, I randomly have a quote here on my desk open. Nothing to do with this podcast. I'm editing a little ebook I'm writing right now, but right in front of me is this great quote from the therapist Robert Stolarow. And he writes, trauma is when severe emotional pain cannot find a relational home in which it can be held.
Jeez Louise. Mm.
And so all the experts on trauma say that trauma, there's capital T trauma, which is not what we're talking about. Then there's small T trauma, which is what we're talking about right now. And meaning capital T trauma is not normative. Small T trauma is normative. It's just the trauma all of us experience living in Western culture. But what they say is that why is it that some people seem to go through trauma and come out not just okay, but often stronger, wiser, and more resilient on the other side, and other people seem to be destroyed by it? And this is an oversimplified answer, but what they basically argue is the difference is not, it doesn't have to do with the trauma or what type of trauma or how intense the trauma it is. The difference mostly has to do with community and relationship. If you experience trauma alone, it tends to be incredibly destructive. If you can experience trauma, whether it's major or minor, capital T or small T, abnormal or normal, with a relational home and just a band of close relationships to hold you in love and listen to you and walk with you, then most of us not only come through it, but we actually come through strong. There's literally a psychological category called post-traumatic growth, where you actually grow and mature and deepen and flourish through traumatic experiences when you go through them in community.
It reminds me of listening, which is so funny because I saw you actually posted about this, but my sister sent me, oh my gosh, is it How We Love? Is that
yes.
the book? Yes.
Yeah,
so
great
listen,
book.
Listening to a, they did a, you can, it's this rant, it feels like old school Napster where you like dig to find a talk, you know, these, that couple did at a church, and my sister found it's a podcast you can actually listen to, but they address how children can go through some of the most gnarly things in the world. And they've seen this in studies around trauma. But as long as someone is sitting down with them and saying, how are you doing? Tell me how you're feeling. It's incredible how much they can synthesize that emotion into a normal and functional thing. Whereas
make meaning of it, discharge it.
Crazy.
There's a famous sociologist named James Pennebaker who conducted with his team one of the first ever like large scale research studies of trauma. And you can read, he has a book called Opening Up. That's like his summary of it. But it was really interesting there. He was asking this question, why do some people seem to be destroyed by trauma or traumatic experiences and other people seem to come through like not unscathed, but come through still healthy and actually often stronger and better in their character? And his theory, like their hypothesis, they went in with a hypothesis, and their hypothesis was it's trauma that has a social stigma attached to it. Wow. And shame attached to it. That's what people can't recover. So they studied a few things specifically, as you would imagine. They studied sexual assault, survivors of sexual assault. And the other thing, this is really interesting, they studied was spouses or whose people whose spouses committed suicide.
Jeez.
Because they imagine if your spouse committed suicide, there would be probably a social stigma and probably an inner sense of shame that came from that, right? Yeah. I don't know that from experience, but I could imagine that. They studied those two things, and they basically found that their hypothesis had zero data behind it. It was completely disproven by the research. And they concluded, their conclusion was that the nature of the trauma has almost no bearing on your capacity to recover from the trauma. And they said that almost all people, not all, and so you have to be really careful here because a lot of people, anybody who's listening, have experienced assault or really hard things. This is very tender. But almost all people who experience trauma and had what Stolarow calls a relational home, had some kind of a family or a support group or a loving parent or somebody to walk with them through, process the pain, discharge the pain, almost all of them made a full emotional recovery.
Wow.
Gosh.
Now, for those listening who have been through trauma and you are alone and you know that you're living with this open wound and limp, that's where, you know, the Christian tradition has some extraordinary resources to offer in what some call inner healing prayer or the healing of memories, which is kind of like charismatic listening prayer meets deep therapy. Mm. And, you know, it's something that we're learning a lot about. I'm doing with people and having done to me, where you basically go back and revisit these very painful memories. But not just in the therapeutic sense of sitting with a good counselor, which is do that. That's really important. But in like a very prayerful sense of listening to God and asking God, because it's not the actual experiences that damage us as much as the interpretations of the experience that damage us.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And the lies and the narratives that enter into our minds. So maybe there's, you know, sexual assault's a very tender, but let's take something more common. Your parents divorced when you're young. Mm. So a lot of children then somehow begin to believe at an unconscious level, not a conscious level, the lie that my parents' divorce was my fault, or the lie that men can't be trusted because my dad left, or women can't be trusted because my mom left, or whatever. And if you were to ask them as an intelligent 32-year-old educated parent, do you believe that your wife can't be trusted because your mom left, or that, you know, you're a bad person and if people actually know who you are, they'll reject you and leave you? They would say, no, I don't believe that because that sounds stupid. But many of us actually do believe that. Yeah. There's that Catholic scholar, Michael Novak, who writes about the three levels of belief. You know, there's public belief, which is what we say we believe. So this is, you know, Harvey Weinstein wearing the pro-women button before 2 weeks before he was found out in the Me Too movement.
Right.
Then there's private belief, which is what we think we believe. Then there's our core belief, which is what we actually believe at a subconscious level, but most of the time we don't realize until we experience suffering or loss. Yeah. And so often our core beliefs are a little hard for us to even see. And in times of suffering, we'll realize, oh, I actually have come to believe this deep lie about my identity, about who I am before God, about my destiny, about other people. And so whether it's therapy or inner healing prayer or something, allowing Jesus and his community to help you go back and make meaning of these memories and reinterpret these painful experiences under the love and the light of the Spirit of God, that can be transformative for people.
Which, isn't it crazy? I feel like as I get older, two of the things that become so profound to me in being a Christian, being a believer, is, and I've thought about this a lot in the last two or three years, is exactly what you just said, Jesus and his people, right? Is the importance of one, scripture, right? Because like, how do you know anything if you don't believe that first? So essentially, what does God have to say about these things? But then two, and I think what has become more and more profound as I've gotten older is that the body is a huge, is central. It's so genius. God's whole thing is so smart because to your point, like when you think about how we get better from trauma, it's healing in a communal sense. And that God is like, that's the setup. It's like people are the setup. The body is the setup. And so much of the importance as I get older, I realize how thankful, and you know, John and his family and a church too, but just how it goes from being this thing you do, because you know, you go, and my dad's a pastor, and you know, you do the thing and it's great. But man, as you get older, it becomes so necessary. And I think to navigate, it's the boat we get through the river with, you know, it's like, and I think I never got that until I started to get old enough, really in the last two or three years, of going, man, I don't know how you do this without more people. And then I think you double down, which you actually spoke to, I think maybe in Garden City a little bit about this, but this idea of like, we get so self-centric, you know, and it becomes, we're miserable. And I think, man, if there's anything that I look out and see in the world, it's this, if you, you know, I know, and I'm fascinated by this whole thing, but you know, the kind of like walking away from the faith and what you just said to me is a really profound insight into that, because it, you know, it seems to happen with the people in my world who've struggled with that. It always starts with pain. Yes, and I think if what you just said is true, it's because it's the first tell of what the structure is. Is there really something that I believed, and maybe I didn't believe it like I did, because when it comes up against this bigger and stronger force, it doesn't seem to stand against that. And so I think it's really fascinating to me thinking about those things and how, especially now, how social media, how much we're staring at ourselves and how miserable everybody is, that we're the most non-communal in a pseudo communal society.
Yes.
You feel like you're tethered to everybody because of these
you're
things.
Not. No. You know? we mistake connectivity for community.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah.
Very
so
well
it's,
said.
It's what M. Scott Peck called pseudo community. And Matt, I could not agree more. I literally taught on this yesterday when this airs. We're recording this on a Monday morning, but you can edit that out. I'm so sorry.
No, it's great. This is the timeless internet.
Yeah, that's
now we just space. Have to put this out today now.
Yeah.
So.
But I taught on deconstruction and just all the facets of that, give my best take on why we're living through a generation-wide moment of deconstruction where so many Gen X millennials are just abandoning anything that even resembles Orthodox faith or faith in general. And I said the same thing. It almost always starts with an emotional wound. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking about, I was chatting to, this is kind of a random aside, but it has to do with exactly what you're saying. This is my way of agreeing with you. But
that's a great start to anything.
Over talking is my way of agreeing with you. But I was talking to an expert on deliverance, as in like demonic deliverance, as we were dealing. Like real life, full on stuff. We were dealing with an exorcism that we had to do a few months ago. And it
y'all
was a very,
had to do?
Yes. And it was very, it's a long story, but it was very intense. And we've been experiencing like just an extraordinary kind of manifestation of the demonic in our church and life and family. And that's a separate conversation. But in consulting with this expert before I went into this exorcism kind of prayer day, one of the things he said that was really profound is that, and I've read this from other experts in that same field, that emotional wounds often are the portals for the demonic into our life.
Jeez Louise. Hmm.
And he called it double trauma. So you have the original trauma of fill in the blank, abuse, assault, death, bereavement, the trauma of having a bad church experience, of being wounded by a spiritual leader, of your pastor having a moral failing. This is all a kind of trauma. It's an emotional hurt, a wound. And then often if those are not healed through loving community, truth, all the discipleship stuff, if they're left to fester, they often become the portal for the demonic in our life. And again, I'm not talking about like demon possession kind of thing where some person's foaming out the mouth. It could just be the portal this is not how Western Christians think, but in most of church history, for sure in the desert tradition, the Eastern tradition, in the Gospels, for sure in Paul, for sure in the Gospel writers, the primary example of the demonic is lies that come into our mind about God, about ourselves, about life. That's the primary example before all the other demonic stuff that probably comes into our mind when we think of deliverance or we're imagining like all the crazy stuff from a poltergeist movie. And that's all true. But you look at Jesus' primary interaction with the devil. It's Matthew chapter 4 and Luke chapter 4. He's in the desert. It's a conversation between Jesus in the desert about truth and lies going on, most likely in the inner dialogue of Jesus' mind. And he's having to resist the perversion and warping of truth and even the warping of scripture by setting his mind on truth and trusting in God. So they would say that Jesus in the desert in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, that's our primary template for demonic manifestation. Jesus in his most in-depth teaching on the devil called the devil the father of lies and said when he lies, he speaks his native language. So all that to say, I think that often emotional wounds, major or minor, and often we receive, there's no way to live in church and not receive emotional wounds from other Christians. It's going to happen at some point. Mm-hmm. Those often become the portals for demonic lies that pervert and warp our faith and often drag us away from a trusting, loving relationship with Jesus.
I think that you, it requires a self-awareness that, you know, I have a million reasons why I would recommend this book, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. But maybe first and foremost is like, there's all kinds of stats in here. And I wrote down all these stats that you put in the book that blew my mind. Like, you know, the average iPhone user touches their phone 2,617 times a day.
Is that insane? That's average. That's not, it's higher for millennials.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, but my point is I feel like it's so helpful for me. And I finished this book maybe a couple of weeks ago, and it has sort of flipped the mirror back on myself a little bit and allowed me to see the water that I'm swimming in every day.
Yes.
And has allowed me to sort of see, like, you know, I have some awareness of some of the lies that are in my head and some of the battles that I fight. And maybe 5-10 years ago, I didn't even know that some of these directions I was taking, I was at crossroads the whole time, you know?
Yes.
So I'm slowly peeling that stuff back and realizing it's a slow process of realizing, okay, here are some of the lies that are in my head. And here's sort of the source of where they come from. And I think it requires, again, my number one reason to recommend this book is like, even if you're not a believer, even if you're wherever you're coming from, read this book and take some of the practices away, and you will begin to see some of, you know, the true layers of yourself. And then that's the only way that you're going to be able to then move forward, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that makes me think of a stat that's not in the book because it came out after I wrote the book. But this last year, Barna did that, like, most extensive research of 26 different countries of basically millennial Christian faith, the state of millennial Christian faith. And one really interesting stat was that the average millennial, and this would be higher for Gen Z, consumes 3,000 hours of digital content a year, and only 100, and this was a measurement for Christian millennials, only 150 of the 3,000 is Christian content.
Wow.
Now, I'm not saying we just need to listen to more Christian podcasts and that's the answer, but if your ratio of secular input to Jesus truth input is 20-1,
right,
that is a problem.
Yeah,
like that,
yeah,
there's no way that's not going to warp your faith and your view of God and yourself and the world.
You said something, and this is something that I think is so fascinating about your story that you lead off with in Hurry, and you actually reference in Garden City, is, I don't know if you remember that about your own books, but I thought I'd remind you.
I don't, to clarify, I don't go back and read my own books. I don't.
I don't, like, listen, oh, this to my is own great. Either.
I'm taking notes and highlighting.
God, that's good. Who was that? That was me? Oh my God, it must be the Spirit. But I think something that's so unique and really profound about your story, and it has to do with everything we've talked about, because it has to do with, one, you know, when I read Falling Upward, which is such a seminal book on this idea, as is Halftime, you know, these books that are about this kind of the first part of life, the second half of life.
Yes.
And you spoke to sort of Up and Right, you know, but your story is so fascinating to me, and I'm always enamored with people that go small, that, like, no, I'm going small here. Yeah, I can go big or I can go small, I can go small. And I think, to your point, one of the other things that I think is really fascinating that I would pay you $1 million if you could do this because you're smart enough, but hear someone really eloquently speak on, it could be a war between you and Malcolm Gladwell, but, like, is how success to me is just as much of a trampoline into that same dilemma. is how, you know, it can be tragedy, it can be loss, but it also success is this really, to me, it's the most backdoor of all of them because it seems so good. And yeah. you go through it, and then you're suddenly on the other side of this thing. It's Solomon's Quest. It's what he warned us about. He tried to shot call this years ago, and nobody, we still don't pay attention. But, you know, that we go, wow, I'm through this thing now, and it's not giving me this stuff. It's not right. doing the thing, right? And so I think you have to, it's exactly what John was saying. You know, you have to have the self-awareness, but the world is always going to go, big, 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 go big, go big, big.
Right.
And so it's, I love this about your story that you went, I did the mega church thing. It was, and I think everybody that would have any sense would look from the sidelines is going, look at JMC's crushing it. It's happening. But you had to have this moment.
Everybody except for my wife and kids.
Touche, touche.
Those like, he's sure. exhausted and where's not dad? Present and grouchy and irritable all of the time.
Right, right. But I think like you had to go through this catharsis moment to go, you know, one, I'm not thriving. This is not. But two, you have to know yourself. You have to go, this doesn't fit with what. And so I'm always fascinated by this thing that the world sort of goes, hey, you owe us these things. You got that gift, give it to us. But then God has this weird way of going like, no, here's actually what I need you to do. And the collision of those things is fascinating to me, you know, and how people navigate that, I think, as parents, how we navigate that, what calling looks like, what you talk so much about in Garden City. But it's I love seeing that in you because I always think that is one of the, I think as a believer, it's one of the most profound and loudest ways we can speak into the culture is to go, you talk about this with Sabbath, you know, to fight against the tide, to go, I'm not going bigger, I'm going smaller, I'm going more intentional, I'm going more focused, you know, especially when you have a gift, like when God has obviously given you a really substantial gift to go, my iteration of this gift is not as big as the world iterates it.
That's
so fascinating to me. Like how did you land? Like, I know a lot of that was hard, but that had to be really hard. I'm sure people in your life were like, dude, what are you doing? You know?
Oh, people told me I was turning my back on God's call in my life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I felt like all my most important days were all behind me and I would just kind of manage mediocrity until I died. Honestly,
would you write a book called Managing Mediocrity? I would love that.
You know, I mean, I got to it how most of us get to it, through pain, through the failure of success and the hidden failure that comes from success. And for
those who don't know the scenario we're referring to here, you were preaching like six sermons a week or a weekend, right? You're just crushing it. And then you decided, you went to your church and you said, hey, I'm going to do one campus. I'm preaching, you know, to one campus a week. I'm going to really scale down and be like the teaching pastor, whatever.
Exactly that.
Just to give people a reference. Yeah.
Yeah. We planted a church. It grew really fast. It was really big. I was a disaster emotionally and relationally. There's no like scandal per se. There's nothing like, you know, big secret that came out or something, but I was just really,
but you just knew,
immature. I mean, it was a really sobering moment where I realized I could be a success as a mega church pastor with a couple asterisks there and a failure as a disciple of Jesus and a human being.
Wow.
A failure. And I look, you know, you get to a certain age. There's this cool thing that's like when you're in your 20s, you feel your human nature feels really like plastic and pliable. Like through your 20s, you're asking the question, like, who will I become? Like I used to play music and the author thing is like a little bit similar in that you're trying to make it.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And so you're sitting around, like you probably all have friends that are your age that are like still trying to make it. And you're like, bro, you didn't make it. It's okay. Be a mechanic, be a pastor, be a plumber. It's okay. You're not going to be the next Bono or whatever, you know? But there's that sense of like, you're waiting around for I remember waiting around for Toby McKeon for Goatee Records to call, would he call me? And he eventually did. But I remember like literally waiting by my first cell phone I ever had, my Sprint cell phone. Like anytime a phone number would come that I didn't recognize, I'd pick it right up. Is this Toby McKeon? Is this Goatee Records? Please be yes. I was like, no, this is an infomercial or whatever, you know? But I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. But there's this sense of kind of waiting around for success to happen. Hmm. And you don't realize how traumatic much of that is. And so anyway, all that to say, in your 20s, you have the sense of who will I become? I'm plastic. This, anything could happen. Mm-hmm. But that, what 20-somethings don't realize is that feeling goes away. And it is replaced by like, dang, this is who I became. Seriously. And I don't mean, and I have a high horizon of possibility for spiritual formation. And at a character level, I still think the best is, you know, I'm really hopeful for who I'll become in my 60s and 70s over the long haul of, you know, what Peterson called the long obedience in the same direction. Mm-hmm. But by my 30, kind of by 30, early 30s, I had enough time under my belt that I could then chart the kind of trajectory of my character arc. And mm-hmm. I could imagine myself at that point at 40, 50, 60, 70, and who I imagined myself to be based on data points of the last 30 years. Was really sobering because I saw somebody that was still an Orthodox Christian and faithful to his wife at a sexual level. But after that, I saw an unhappy marriage, an irritable, unhappy person, a leader who was obsessed with power and not aware of his shadow side, kids that probably wanted nothing to do with the church because church was dad's mistress in a sense. You know what I mean? That was who dad had an affair with. He was sexually right. faithful to his wife, but he just worked all the time and tried to find his identity and meaning and sense and success as a pastor or author or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just saw myself, like, it just looked like an empty hollow. Who wants that? You know? Mm-hmm. And so it was a really sobering moment. Stephen Covey has that famous exercise that really every person should do at some point, where he has you write your eulogy in advance. Have you heard about this? He has you sit down and you write the eulogy that you would want said at your funeral. And then you work backwards from there. Yeah. Like, if that's what I want, you know, David Brooks in his book, The Road to Character, which is a great book, by the way, has, and his newest book, Since Then, is even better, The Second Mountain. But in the intro to Road to Character, he talks about what he calls resume virtues versus eulogy virtues. And he talks about how our culture is all built around resume virtues. Like, okay, cool. So Dave, like, you're a singer-songwriter. How many records have you sold? How successful are you? How much money do you have? Where do you live? What's your family? What's your thing? What do you drive? Like, all the resume stuff. But when we die, nobody freaking cares. And we don't care. What matters is who we became and the people we became that person with. It's what, you know, two authors I love call our relational soul, right? That's all that will last into eternity, is who we have become through our discipleship to Jesus and the relationships we have forged along the spiritual path. That is what will be here 10,000 years from now. Not any of this. Who cares if my book sells a lot of copies or no copies, if people like me or hate me, if my church is this size or that? Just none of that even matters, you know? So all that to say that there's something, I had that existential, like, I feel like I had an early midlife crisis. And I realized, man, I'm on a trajectory based on Western up and to the right resume virtues, not on eulogy virtues, character, way of Jesus, relationships, who am I as a husband, as a father. And that's not to say that now, you know, however many years later, I have it all down and I'm never tired and I'm always unhurried and I'm just like the walking Jesus Zen awesome guy, you know.
Yeah. You're like the Christian, the dude.
Yeah.
You're the Big Lebowski, but the Christian version.
I am not. You know, David Brooks says you have to write yourself into a better life. And so that's why I wrote that book. And it didn't solve all my problems, it turns out. It's still hard to slow down and live inside your limits and be present.
You speak to this. And one of the things that I think I think of all the things you said in the book. And again, you sort of hint at this. This is why Garden City is such a fun read. Especially after her, even though they're not in chronological order, because you see you sort of beginning the riff, you know, you can see you sort of exploring, but not really, you know, it's like the beginning it's like the beginning of that sort of theme before it gets actually written. But, you know, your thoughts on Sabbath have just been so challenging. And I think, and obviously they're not native to you, but I think you've done such a good job sort of extrapolating and sort of expanding on that theme. And I think what you say that's so great about slowing down, it's what Hurry is about, you know, the book is really about, is to know ourselves, know the Lord more, you got to have the space. There's a speed. Love has a speed, as you say. You
know,
it's like, and so I think to your point about how do we do these things better? How do we not get into these things where everything is so frenzied and we don't know ourselves and we're making decisions that are counterintuitive to how we're actually made? You have to have this way of living at a pace where you can actually think and contemplate and go, do I like this? Do I want to do this? Am I happy? Does this feel native to what I'm doing? I would love, I know, you know, you've got to go, you've got all those people who love and want you. But one of the couple things that I feel like we'd be remiss for not just sort of having you talk a little bit on quickly is, this, which boy, the irony there. Do you love that? Quickly.
Yes. Quickly.
Speak on the Sabbath quickly. But can you, I really think, again, Hurry to me, ruin me, but man, the death knell to me was this, and it's something I'm trying to practice more. My wife and I were talking about this last night, is just how to do that. Like, I watched your video on the workbook, which was so helpful, the ways that you've sort of said what you've got into your, you know, you and your family's life, and it's incredible and wildly overwhelming. But how would you sort of, for those who are listening who I think are probably like me, they mean well, and they think of the Sabbath and they do church and it's a little slower than the rest of the days. But I think the way you say it is a pushback one, which is so profound to me. It's not just resting. It's a pushing back against the weight and the inertia of just sort of our culture. But how would you sort of give like the thought of that? What would be like a good introductory thought to those of us who are like, I want to do that better. I just kind of don't know how or how to think about it.
Yeah. Well, I would say two very simple things. One is start with the end in mind. So, you know, you have to start with like, what's the ache in your heart and who do you want to become? And then back your way up to habits like Sabbath that will habituate you into the vision of the life that you want to have. So that's the Stephen Covey, write your eulogy. You know, what you're talking about, metrics for success, our culture hands us metrics for success. And so if we accept them, and our family of origin hands us metrics for success. So if we accept them uncritically, if they're good, great. If they're not good, problem. So like, take a little time to talk, dream, pray with your spouse, friends, journal, and attempt to articulate, what are your metrics for success? Is happiness even, is that even the right metric? That's actually not one of my metrics for success. You know, I think often you can be following, I'm not super happy right now. I'm leading a church through COVID-19 in a city that has experienced extraordinary social unrest and demonic oppression. The last year has not been a happy year for me. Do I have joy in God? Yes. Are my morning prayer times rich? Am I grateful? Yes. Am I like walking around laughing and happy right now? No, not really. It's kind of a form of leadership right now, is a kind of a form of suffering. And that's God's call on my life right now. Was Jesus always happy? No. So I'm not down on happiness. I'm pro happiness. But, you know, people use happiness to justify all sorts of sinful things like divorce. I mean, it's one of the primary justifications for divorce and many other things. So you have to identify, and I can't do that for you. And I would strongly encourage you to let Jesus help you define your metrics for success, because I think he probably knows better than you and I do what will actually make for a happy life, you know? As Ignatius of Loyola said, sin is unwillingness to trust that what God wants for me is only my deepest happiness.
Jeez Louise.
So anyway, first start with the end in mind. What's the kind of life? How do you want to die? What's the eulogy you want, Zeb? What are your metrics for success? If you could say this is a life lived well, could you articulate that on a one sheet piece of paper? And then back up and say, all right, so what are some habits to actually move me toward that long-term goal? So if my goal is, I want my kids to grow up to love and follow Jesus, and I want to have a great relationship with them. All right, what are some habits to work toward that? Family dinner, Sabbath, me in therapy, dealing with my shadow side, like, you know, a parent mentor, whatever. There's a thousand different things. Like, do your own thing. Habits. Second thing I would say, first is start with the end in mind. Second is start where you're at, not where you feel you should be. So, you know, the experts on habits, like I'm just reading PJ Fogg's little book, Tiny Habits, right now. And his whole thing is that, yes, habits are kind of the silver bullet for a lot of things, But the problem is if people start with too large of habits, they don't stick and they fall off the bandwagon. This is the New Year's resolution moment. So he has a whole book like on the psychology behind what he calls tiny habits. So for example, he says, if you're trying to floss your teeth every day and you can't, like most of us, then start, like this is not a joke. You literally start by flossing one tooth every night before bed, one tooth. And then you look in the mirror and you smile. And apparently the smile does some like neurobiological thing to seal the habit in your brain. Like you associate it with a happy feeling. And like you just do one tooth a night. And so, and that's like where a lot of us are. We're like, I can't floss all of my teeth every night before. I can do one tooth. I can do that. So if you apply that logic to spiritual disciplines, start where you're at. So if you're not ready to actually step into the full orb of Sabbath, and Sabbath is a hard one because it's a really high bar of entry. It is by definition a 24-hour time period. And so that's really hard. Like there are other disciplines like scripture or silence and solitude that you can do in short spurts. They're way better long, but they're still, you can at least do a version of them short. Sabbath is like by definition a 24-hour time period, and you could get a doctor on to talk about the neurobiology of what happens to your body over a 24-hour time period and why the experience of Sabbath over 24 hours is categorically different than a 4-hour afternoon off or something. But so I think you should work toward that. But for a lot of people, that's way too high of a bar of entry. That's trying to like floss your teeth and double brush them and put whitener on them and like start where you're at. So if where you're at is, hey, let's go to church. We've already got to church on Sunday. Maybe after church, let's keep our phones at home in a cupboard for 3 hours and let's do brunch as a family, or let's do brunch with another family that we love. And let's just be present to each other. Talk about our highs and lows from the week, a couple gratitudes. And just sit and relax. And then we'll go do our laundry and do the things we need to do and run our errand and whatever. So if that's where you're at, like church and a restful meal, great. Start there. And then try to inch your way forward based on where you're
at. How long did it take y'all to get to where you are now?
It took us years because my wife and I weren't on the same page. So my wife is the opposite of me, which is why she's so much more wonderful than I am on so many levels. Anybody who knows,
that's a theme here on Dadville.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that setup.
People may read me or podcast my books, but in real life, nobody would prefer to hang out with me over my lovely wife, who is so much more fun than me and the opposite. So I'm a rule follower. She's a rule breaker. I'm an introvert. She's an extrovert. I'm a OCD planner. She's totally spontaneous, fly by the seat of her pants. So for her, Sabbath just sounded like more rules. And, you know, Sabbath takes prep work and takes planning in order to actually like, for example, to turn your phone off for 24 hours and to not have to, I have to answer that email, I have to do this, I have to run that errand, all that stuff's done other times. That takes a fair bit of like structure, planning, you know, organization to your week flow. So that's just like, she hates that stuff, you know, and she had no theological paradigm for it. It was just a weird legalistic thing. And it kind of got into our marriage, like the rule person wants to add a whole new rule. And this rule is 24 hours long. No, thank you. So we were just not, and I didn't have anybody to mentor. And I didn't come from a tradition that had Sabbath. I literally read this random little book by Abraham Joshua Heschel on the Sabbath. I'd never even thought about the Sabbath before. I think I'd heard Pete Scazzaro like say a couple of things about it. I'm like, what is the Sabbath? Is that like for Seventh-day Adventists and Jews? Like, what is that for? You know? So it took me years to even get my head around the theology of it, my body into the practice of it. And then once my wife got on board and kind of got the why behind and then started to actually taste it in her body, what it has transformed us. And now she's like more into it than I am. So it's such an anchor part of our family's life together because it's an incredibly bonding time for our family. Like we're together for the Sabbath. And so it's like, it's also like family day too, in a sense, you know? So anyway, it took us all that. It's a long way of saying it was years before Sabbath was even like a super disciplined rhythm in our life. And it was joy. And part of that is because we didn't have anybody mentor us. So part of what I'm trying to do is like what maybe took us 7 years. Let me help people figure out how to do that in 7 months. You know, like here's some practices, here's some teachings, here's a step by step, here's a workbook. Like, let me walk you. We've done a practice for it for our church. Like, let me walk you into that. It shouldn't have to take you that long. But there's always a time mark with any. I'll end with this. Learning theorist is not a Christian concept, just a learning theorist concept. Talk about the J curve. So if you can, you can Google this if you want, the J curve. But if you can imagine a graph of time on one axis and difficulty on the other axis, when you start a new behavior, it often gets, you get worse at it, and it's really hard at first, and you tend to feel worse at it, and then you get better with it over time. So let me use a music example. I remember when I first started playing guitar back in the pre-YouTube days, when you actually had to learn guitar from like people, and you had to be like, bro, show me a lick or show me a new chord. You couldn't just Google like new chord or whatever, or have some like wicked smart person teach you on YouTube, right? You actually had to like find a person to teach you guitar. So I remember, like most guitarists, when I started picking, I did it all down, you know what I mean?
Downstrokes or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And then somebody told me like, oh, actually you're supposed to go down, up, down, up, down, up. And if you do all down, you can never pick past a certain speed and it'll slow you down. So you actually need to reteach yourself how to pick by going down, up, down, up. And I remember when I'd been playing guitar long enough that I felt like I was not good yet, but proficient. And then when I started trying to pick down, up, down, up, down, up, I was horrible. All these things that before, these licks I could play, these little, you know, pieces I could play, sounded crappy, and I was missing notes and playing clumsy and slow. I got worse. And then eventually I got back to where I was. And then eventually I got twice as good.
Yeah.
So what happens for a lot of people is they're like, I already have a day off. I enjoy my day off. It's not really a Sabbath, but I like, we have church and we do these things and it's fun. And then they'll try to practice Sabbath and they feel it's like the emotional equivalent of trying to learn to relearn to pick. It's like, this is horrible. I'm stressed out. I'm anxious. We didn't do these things. I'm itching for my phone. And they feel, why would I do this? And then they give up right about the bottom of the J curve. Again, Google this. They give up right at the bottom, right when it bottoms out and you're about to start getting better. Like, this sucks. I'm not doing this. And I'm like, just stick with it. You'll eventually get back. And then it will become extraordinary as you, it's a skill. It's an embodied skill, like playing the piano or playing guitar or riding a bike or playing soccer. You have to get it into your muscle memory because Sabbath is something you do with your body, not just your mind. And that's the gift of it. But that means it takes your body time to relearn new circadian rhythms and habits and ways of being. And once it relearns it, the beauty of the body is how God created it. This is the problem of sin and the gift of spiritual formation is the body will just naturally start to do it for you. In the same way that you get in a car or on a bike and you're not thinking about how to drive a car or ride a bike anymore, your body has now memorized. There was a time when it was really hard. It took a ton of effort and discipline and you were scared about it. And now you don't even think about it. Your body has memorized how to do it. And this is the problem of sin because our body does this with sin too. And it's the gift of spiritual formation. So at first Sabbath will feel like riding a bike or learning to play the piano. It will feel like you just suck. But eventually as it gets into your body's muscle memory, like you will just every Friday evening, my body just has this like experience of calming and my whole body just begins to transition and my mind begins to slow and my spirit starts to feel deep emotions, which are not often good. And then those emotions start to pass through me. Like there's just this thing. My body remembers the Sabbath now and lives in the Sabbath. And so all that to say, stick with it. So I'd say, you know, start with the end in mind, start where you're at, not where you should be, and stick with it.
God, that's amazing. Well, and
for people who are going to try, I will say from personal experience, because I just tried this yesterday. I just finished your book, you know, 2 weeks ago. We tried it yesterday, right? And like, just a heads up, you're going to feel... I mean, all the things that the book describes about like all the, you know, like I wanted to try to not buy anything. Right. I wanted to try to like, let's not, I don't want to be on my phone. There's all kinds of stuff. I was hit with like a rush of, I have never wanted my, it was almost like my brain saw everything that we needed in the house so clearly. Like whenever my wife is like, hey, I'm making a, you know, shipped order. Do we need anything? I'm like, I can't think of anything right now. Like, there's no way. In that, like, Sunday morning, I was like, oh, we don't have any milk. I need my espresso with milk. I had this clear list of everything that we needed. And I also, like, I just want, like, all those people that I forgot to text last week, it's all coming to me.
Paramount.
So just buckle up, because you're going to be hit with a wave of tasks.
It's like my dad always said, if you ever forget what you need to do for the day, just act like you're praying. And all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, I need to, oh yeah, and have that lunch thing. Okay, so John Mark, a couple things that we have, two questions we ask everybody before we send them back into the wild. And I would love to know what you know, it sounds like you've actually thought about this. You're sort of cheating, but I'll ask the first one. What is the one thing that you want your kids to know?
Oh, just how good God is.
That's great.
That's a great answer.
You're a pro. That was good.
All right. Last question here. And before I ask it, I do just want to say thank you so much for doing this podcast. We were so excited. And I don't know if you read the fine print on the email, but you did sign up for 9 more sessions with us. So
I missed that. So yeah. Sorry.
It's okay. Well,
it's okay.
I have a new part-time job for Dad Bill.
That's right.
Okay, so what is it that you want your kids to say at your funeral? What's that eulogy?
Now you're putting me on the spot. I did that exercise like 10 years ago. I would want them to talk about someone, not who was perfect, but who was aware of his failures and who was transformed over time. So I would love to them to talk about, this is what Dad was like when I was little, and this is who he became over the 60 years I knew him. And this is what Jesus did to him as he continued to surrender to Jesus in quiet prayer and community. And that gives me hope for who I can become in Jesus.
I'll say this quickly. We had our buddy Matt Carney on a couple of weeks ago, and Matt, I've thought about this so much, and it's so funny you brought that up, but I think I just want to say this, because I think everybody that's listening, this is a profound thing to me. I think it's easy for me to forget that even as parents, we're changing, and that sounds ridiculous, because of course we are, but I think sometimes to me, if I'm not careful as a parent, and maybe those who are listening feel the same way, it's like you're just trying to get the stuff you know to do right. That's enough change. You're just trying to nail...
You're just trying to survive. Yeah.
You're just trying to survive. Yeah. But you say it well. I think it's so important to remember we're always in flux. Always. Yeah. We're always getting to be, hopefully, to be more like God and change. But I think that to me is a profound gift to our children, is that it wasn't like Dad sort of nailed it at 45 and then he was 40 years of that. It's that he was always changing, apologizing, you know, loving, fixing.
An A++ score as a dad is not an option.
Yeah, that's right.
We will sin against our kids, and we will wound our kids, and we will pass sin on to the next generation. But repenting and being humble and changing over time is all an option with Jesus.
Jeez. So, no better way to end this. Dude, you are the best. Thank you for coming.
Oh, you guys
are
great.
Thank you so much, man.
Maybe not 9 more, but let's do another one this fall or something,
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with For King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.